The saying goes that God created humankind in God's own image, and that we are more than happy to return the favor. We like to imagine that God is a lot like us. Well, I like to imagine that maybe God's a little bit stronger, wiser, more powerful. So maybe God's a little bit like the $6 million man or something. Faster, stronger. But pretty much God's a lot like us. Maybe we get God a little bit confused with Santa Claus sometimes, I think. You know, God's a old, white man with a big, white beard sitting up somewhere watching us and taking notes. And when we're good, God rewards us. And when we're bad, we get coal in our stockings. And that's what God is like. Maybe it's too much Renaissance art that depicted God as an elderly man in a white robe. Or maybe that's just seeped into our consciousness somehow. Now, I could go on, and I often do, particularly with kids, about how God, you know, doesn't have flesh, let alone a flesh tone that we could nail down. And God doesn't have, you know, a human body, so, you know, facial hair or gender. These are metaphors. These are just imaginings, ways in which we kind of picture and image God, perhaps, but we know that that's not what God is really like, and we could imagine God looking like something else, and that would be okay. And I do think that in some ways, I mean, there's a reason God said, you will not make an image of me and then worship it, because that image becomes limiting, and then we think that that's what God is like. But the sort of visual images we have of God, the visual ways in which we make God look like us, and therefore confine God, those are nothing. Those are simple. Those are tame. In comparison to the other attributes, the other human attributes that we project upon God and then think that God acts like us, limit God, confine God, or at least limit and confine our understanding of God to someone who is just as perhaps flawed and imperfect and in some ways hurtful as we are. And so we imagine that God operates on the same systems of rewards and punishments that we set up in our world. We imagine that God has just as much difficulty forgiving as we do, just as much difficulty loving as we do. We imagine that God's power is limited to the things that we can see and understand. We imagine that God's grace is limited to the places where we would show or receive grace. We imagine that God's power works the way we think power should work. We imagine that God operates under the cause and effect that we see everywhere else in the world. And so if something bad happens, there must have been a reason, a deserved reason for that punishment. And if something good happens, then we can pat ourselves on the back. The book of Job, which the lectionary barely does justice to by kind of sprinkling a few passages here and there, and your pastor's doing no justice to by only talking about it at the very end of its little turn in the lectionary this fall. But the book of Job is this fascinating, wonderful exploration of justice or lack thereof, of power or lack thereof, of trying to come around to understanding how God and the universe work and why suffering happens and what we're to do in the face of it. I mean, it's a phenomenal story and philosophical and theological discussion of these things. We know the basic outline. There's this man, Job, who loses just about everything. His children, his livelihood, his home. Still got his wife, but she's nagging and complaining. Well, I mean, can we blame her? She's lost everything too. We only get Job's perspective, but she has also lost her children, her home, her livelihood. And Job's spouse and friends and the people around him try to help him understand what's been happening. Job insists he's done nothing to deserve this, but you know, different people come to him with different explanations. Well, you must have done something. Or the God you worship is a monster and you should curse that God. And if that means you die, then that means you die. It's better than this. Or are you sure that you've really understood what God wanted of you? Maybe it was something else. And so on and on for nearly 40 chapters, 37, 38 chapters, these friends and family members of Job's have been trying to help him understand, they think. speaking for God, speaking for Job, speaking for justice, trying to clear this up with their own understandings of how the world works. And the author has laid out just about every argument you could possibly make about why suffering happens to good people and what we should do about it. And basically, none of them seem to be helping Job. And finally, the author lets God have a word in edgewise. And so God speaks to Job, not in a still, small voice, not in one kind of relatively contained burning bush. God speaks to Job out of a mighty whirlwind and says, as my Christian history professor used to paraphrase this passage, "Hey, where were you when I created the world, tough guy? You think you understand how this works? You think you can fit me into a box? Into some understanding of cause and effect, of right and wrong, that can make it okay that people suffer? That can justify that somehow? You think if you can squish me in somehow, that then this makes more sense?" That's not the way it works. Power is not what you think it is. Righteousness or justice, it's not what you think it is. I am not who you think I am. Well, James and John have the exact same problem, but from the other end. Job's been looking at punishment and misunderstanding justice and equality and things like that from punishment side. And James and John are looking at reward. But they're just as misled and they just as fully misunderstand God. And so they say to Jesus, "Hey, you know, we've been really good disciples. Been helping you out, right, man? So I tell you what, when you come into your glory and it's time for promotions, put us on your right and left side. Give us some title. We don't need money. But give us some title. Give us some honor. Give us a seat at your table." You know, they're thinking like that Jesus is some sort of cosmic CEO, and he's going around handing out these merit-based bonuses, you know? Assistant to the Messiah. Comes with lots of perks, like sitting on Jesus' right and left side or something. And Jesus says, "You don't understand, that's not what it's about. It's not about what God's gonna do for you, but what about what God is already doing. It's not about what you get from God for your service, but about what you are willing to give up in God's service." And the other disciples are like, "Whoa, you're even like considering this? Come on, this isn't fair." And he says to all of them then, "You don't understand." Talking to Jesus must have been like playing backwards day with a kid. You know, he's always coming out with these really bizarre things. "You don't understand. If you want to be first, you have to be last. If you want to be the most powerful, you need to be the lowliest servant." He says stuff like that all the time. "You want to save your life, lose it." What is he talking about? It's not what you think it is. Power is not what you think it is. Justice is not what you think it is. Fairness and equality and what it means to be beloved by God, that's not what you think it is. I'm not who you think I am, and God is certainly not who you think God is. Like Job, like James, like John, we sometimes go around with these understandings of God that are based on the way we work, because that's the way we think. As if we can confine God to our ideas and our understanding of the world. And we get a little limited. We need to open it up a bit more. I have an exercise for this. Click. We have four dots, right? And the trick is, the challenge is to connect these four dots using only three straight lines and to form one enclosed space, that all the dots are connected to each other in a straight line, and you have one enclosed shape. So people try lots of ways to do that. Like this. Nope. Or this. Nope. Or that. Anybody see it yet? Next. The trick is that the way to do this is to think beyond what is presented to you. What it looks like is a box. It looks like a box, and that's the way we normally think about it. But instead, if you go outside the box and you draw the lines beyond the edge and connect them, you have a different puzzle there. And you get, of course, a triangle, which is the only enclosed shape you can make with three straight lines. But you get a triangle that extends beyond the limits of kind of the way in which the problem was presented. Thank you. Now, I think that when we try to think about God in our human understandings, when we think about God in terms of what we think is fair, or how we think cause and effect works, or what we think justice or mercy or forgiveness or love are, that we're seeing our own puzzle, but we're seeing confines. We're still inside a box, and we're trying to put God in there with us, because then we'll understand God better, and we'll feel better about the world and more in control of it if God is understandable in our box. But God won't be contained in that box. When I started thinking about how God isn't contained inside our boxes, I immediately jumped to Isaiah 55, 8, I think. I had to look it up. I didn't know that off the top of my head. My thoughts are not your thoughts, and my ways are not your ways. And I thought, yeah, see, there you go. God's thoughts, God's ways are not our ways. And that's the sum total of it. But like any good exploration into the Bible, you can't just read one verse. You got to see the context that it's written in. And when you read Isaiah 55, it begins with an invitation. God is speaking through the prophet and says, "Oh, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And you that have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good and delight yourselves in rich food." And a little bit later, God says, "I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David, a witness to my people, a leader and commander for the peoples." And even later than that, verse 6, "Seek the Lord who may be found and call upon God who is near. Let the wicked forsake their ways and the unrighteous their thoughts. Let them return to the Lord who will have mercy on them, and to our God who will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are my ways your ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." It's not only in times of suffering or trying to outdo one another that God says, "Whoa, back up, my thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways." But here in Isaiah, we see that perhaps primarily, the place in which God is beyond our box, the place in which God's thoughts and ways transcend our own, are in places of scarcity and abundance, places of new life and new covenant versus being locked into the old ways, places of forgiveness versus the places where we feel we are unforgivable. When it comes to justice and mercy and forgiveness, God's ways are not our ways. God will not be contained in our box of what we think can be forgiven of ourselves and of one another. When it comes to feeling dried up and that all of our life has just been sucked out of us, God's ways are not our ways. God will not be contained in that box of dead end, of lifelessness, but offers new covenant, new life. When it comes to feeling hungry and thirsty and that there is never enough to go around, and even when there is enough to go around, we can't make it get to everyone who needs it. God's ways are not our ways. God's thoughts are not our thoughts, and God will not be contained in that box of scarcity, but is a God of abundance. Most especially when it comes to blessing, when it comes to new life, when it comes to forgiveness, when it comes to love, to grace. God will not be contained or controlled. God will not be hedged or fenced in. God will not be shut into a box, but will always break out of it. And the uncontrollable, uncontainable, unlimited love and grace, blessing and life of God calls us far outside the box to the place where that grace dwells and to the place where that grace calls us. Amen.